speaker is Ruth Kalaski Leibowitz, who has her PhD from Harvard in Italian Reformation Studies, where she worked with Myron Gilmore. Since then, her work has been in Italian religious history, and she is currently teaching at Boston College. The title of her paper will be Conversion or Confinement: Houses for Repentant Prostitutes in Late Renaissance Italy. This paper will consider the response in 16th century Italy to one form of deviance from accepted Christian morality, namely female prostitution. In the early part of the century, prostitution started to receive more attention, partly because of the arrival of syphilis. And social reformers conceived several new welfare institutions designed to reduce its incidence. First of all, they offered girls and women already in prostitution an opportunity for rehabilitation, which they saw in spiritual rather than in social terms. The houses of convertite, or repentite as they were called, revived the medieval idea of providing a sheltered environment where prostitutes who repented of their licentiousness could atone for it through a life of asceticism. These houses were often dedicated to Mary Magdalene and were modeled along convent lines. Two other institutions concentrated on prevention: the Zitelle, or Vergini Miserabili, for poor girls, particularly for daughters of prostitutes, assisted them in finding respectable careers in marriage, the convent, or domestic service. Finally, there were loosely structured houses called the Soccorso, or Rifugio, to assist married women in difficulties. This paper will focus primarily on the houses of convertite and will examine how they functioned in Italian cities later in the 16th century. The evolution of these houses over the course of the century yields some insight about social institutions in a Roman Catholic area of early modern Europe. By the 1570s, houses of convertite were in existence in many of the cities and towns of northern and central Italy. In Florence, Siena, and Bologna, the old medieval foundations of convertite had been revived and enlarged. There were new foundations in Rome, Verona, Milan, Bergamo, Vicenza, Venice, Brescia, and elsewhere. From the records of ecclesiastical and civil officials who were concerned with their administration, we are able to get a good picture of how the houses were functioning at this time. In addition to these sources, there are also substantial counter-reformation visitations, both papal and episcopal. Those for the houses of convertite in Milan and Siena include interviews with the individual sisters, which add specific biographical information about the convertite and the dimension of their personal experience. By the standards of 16th century institutions, the houses were of a fair size, and they had complex structures. The membership of the Convertite of Santa Valeria in Milan in 1580 was 142. The Convertite of Brescia in 1580 had 60 members. That of Santa Elisabetta in Florence in 1575 had 135, and the Convertite of Siena in 1575 had 31. These numbers parallel the size of Italian convents of the time. However, the House of Convertite in Venice was on a bigger scale. Its membership between 1550 and 1600 generally fluctuated between 200 and 300, but at one point in 1560, it reached a peak of 400 members. There was also a house in Paris at this time which had 200 members. The houses of convertite were internally structured along convent lines. They had a chapter meeting, the customary set of rotating offices, and a daily schedule organized around saying the divine office. Originally, many of these houses had been founded in conjunction with the new hospitals for syphilis, but by the later 16th century. They were usually, the ecclesiastical authorities had asserted their jurisdictional claims over the houses too. So in the 1570s, you usually find them jointly administered by the civil and the ecclesiastical authorities. And on the lay side, this meant a committee of municipally appointed deputies. And on the ecclesiastical side, it meant the house of chaplain and confessor, the episcopal vicar, and all of his superiors. Drawing primarily on the interviews with the Milanese and Sienese conventi, we can construct a partial profile of the membership of these houses. The visitors ask for specific information from each sister, such as her religious status, her length of stay in the house, and they elicited general comments from her about the conditions there. They also asked every sister whether she had entered voluntarily and whether she was remaining voluntarily. These questions, which were also asked of novices and young nuns in ordinary convents at the time, were apparently posed because of the Tridentine decree forbidding forced profession. Since the interviews from the small Sienese house were informal and brief, the bulk of the data comes from the more systematic and very substantial interviews in the large Milanese house of Santa Valeria. The interviews give very precise information about the sisters' ages and geographical origins, but in other respects, they offer only tantalizing hints. They are least satisfying, unfortunately, in the area of the conventicle's past history. Given the institutional context of the interviews, one assumes that one is dealing with a group of ex-prostitutes, but this is not absolutely certain. None of the sisters in Milan or Siena explicitly referred to themselves as having been prostitutes. In many cases, the women gave no specific details about their past to the visitors. In the instances where they did, a great diversity is apparent. In Milan, a recent entrant stated that she was an orphan and a virgin, but she was the only one to make this claim. Another had been the unknowing wife of a bigamist. Another had given birth and then become a wet nurse. There was a nun who had married illegally, and several women convicted of crimes. Three of the sisters in the Sienese house said they had husbands. Except, of course, for the girl who claimed to be a virgin, all the other histories could also have included being a prostitute. In the interviews of the Milanese house, there is the general suggestion of lies of ill repute. According to a couple of sisters, the backbiting in their house included throwing up the defects of the other inmates' past lives. From all this, I concluded tentatively that most of these women had been engaged in prostitution. The data available on the ages of the sisters indicates an early entering and a fairly youthful population. Some cynical contemporaries thought that the conventicle served primarily as a convenient retirement house for aging prostitutes. And there was certainly incentive for the for prostitutes to try and use it in this way because they were required to provide some of the funding from the house. But some of the fines from the minor offenses that they committed went to the conventicle. And also in Florence and Rome, prostitutes making wills had to donate one quarter of their property to the conventicle. But at least in this period, the conventicle do not seem to have been serving as a retirement house. For the Milanese house, we can reconstruct the ages at which the sisters entered Santa Valeria. These ranged anywhere from 10 to 39 years, with the average age of entrance being 18 and the median age 17. More than three-fourths of the sisters entered between the ages of 10 and 20, and the numbers were fairly evenly distributed between these endpoints. The entrance of girls as young as 10 or 11 in Milan suggests that they came in before they became prostitutes, or very shortly after they'd taken up the trade. In the city of Florence, by contrast, it was the policy of the Medici Dukes to permit only ex-prostitutes to enter the Convegite. In 1576, Francesco I refused the request of a Pratoese prostitute that had two still pure daughters, aged 13 and 15, be allowed to enter the Florentine Convegite. The average age of the sisters in Santa Valeria in Milan in 1579 was 33, the median age 31, and the spread of actual ages between 15 and 72. In the Sienese house, unfortunately, the visitor recorded the precise age of only one of the 26 sisters interviewed, and she was under 20. The references of a number of them to their parents suggest a young population. A contemporary describing the Convegite in Venice in 1561 said that the majority of the 400 sisters there were, in quotes, young and beautiful. The data on the geographical origins of the Convegite shows that, like urban convicts on the whole, they had a local and a regional membership. Of the 142 Milanese sisters, half listed their place of origin as the city of Milan. Nearly all the rest came from towns or small centers within an 80-kilometer radius of Milan, with a handful from far-off cities like Rome, Florence, or Trent. The Sienese Convegite did not specifically give their place of origin, but their remarks suggest that they came from the city of Siena or its surrounding towns. The statements of the sisters show that many of them had not broken ties with their families. The latter sometimes had a role in their entrance into the Convegite, and female relatives would come to visit them. Unlike ordinary convents, however, where there were family groupings of sisters, cousins, and aunts within the houses, hardly any of the Convegite had relatives among the other inmates. The interviews show clearly that these sisters had not all entered voluntarily. In the Sienese house, 5 out of 25 nuns, or 20%, stated that they had entered unwillingly. In the Milanese house, a higher percentage, 54 out of 129 sisters responding, 42%, gave the same reply. In the case of the majority of sisters who said they had entered willingly, 80% in Siena and 58% in Milan, they did not elaborate their response, and so we do not really know what voluntary entrance meant to them. It may have been a conversion experience or a decision made on more pragmatic grounds. Those who felt they experienced some form of pressure or duress were more articulate. One Milanese sister, for instance, explained that she was brought from the Deposito, which was an entrance house for the Convegite, against her will, although she did formally give her consent. While the Convegite were more articulate about their feelings than about their specific circumstances, one can get some sense from the interviews about who was pressuring them to enter. The most elusive bits of information concern the women's family. As the visitor recorded Sister Clara Francesca's comments on her entrance, in quotes, "She came from her own house in Milan against her will, but she consented in order to save her life because her relatives were threatening her." In another instance, the sister said she had entered in obedience to her father, but another had guilt feelings because she had entered without her father's consent. The second and much more evident group of who sometimes pressed women to enter were local officials, and their actions relate to some broader trends. There seems to have been, in later 16th century Italy, a policy supported by both church and state to utilize the houses of Convegite more extensively. After Trent, church officials sought to limit the membership in ordinary convents in the interests of their financial viability, and they established a ceiling on the numbers of women allowed for each house. But they pointedly excluded the conventite when making up these lists of sealants. The apostolic visitors to Milan in 1575 commented that the conventite needed larger quarters so they could take in more women. The civil authorities cooperated by helping to administer and finance the houses. In Florence, for instance, the Medici Duke Cosimo III, back in the 1550s, had passed legislation increasing the funds for the Florentine Conventite. In Siena in 1570, his successor provided a new house for the Conventite there. All the sisters in Siena in 1575 had entered the house within the last 5 years. The Milanese sources permit us to see a more detailed picture of how the policy of utilizing the Conventite operated there. Under the leadership of Charles Borromeo, the church took a very active role in founding and reforming religious institutions. In the years between 1565 and 1579, there was a rise in the population of Santa Valeria from 114 in 1565 to 150 in 1575, and then a slight drop off to the plague of 1576 to 142 in 1579. At this point, the house was so full it could not take in any new novices. The older conventite who had been at Santa Valeria for 20 years or more all commented on the changed quality of the house in the last 10 years. And they pointed to the young sisters and to the nuns as the two causes of this. Sister Diodata told the visitor that, in quotes, "For the most part, the younger sisters were brought here by force." Her statement is supported, although not so emphatically, by the statistics of entrance. If one calculates the voluntary and involuntary entrances, first for the decade between 1568 and 1579, the ratio of voluntary to involuntary was 7 to 6. Excuse me, let me circle back on that. If one calculates the voluntary and involuntary entrances, first for the decade between 1568 and 1579, and then for earlier years, the ratios change. For the years before 1568, the ratio of voluntary to involuntary was 8 to 5. For the decade of 1568 to 1579, it was 7 to 6. There was no appreciable change in the ages of entrance, though, between these two time groups. The more recent entrants usually stated the place from which they had immediately entered the conventite. About a quarter of the girls and women entering between 1568 and 1579 came from the local Socorso, and a much smaller fraction in the last 5 years from the Deposito. Although the statistics from these two groups do not show a higher proportion of claimed involuntary entrants than the whole body of entrants from the decade, it is clear that there was a channeling of inmates from other institutions into the conventite. As the statement of the novice from the Deposito quoted earlier suggests, varying degrees of pressure could be exerted through these institutional procedures. The other group referred to by the older sisters, the nuns, were a small group of delinquent nuns who had been taken out of their convents by the ecclesiastical authorities and sent to do penance at Santa Valeria. Thus, the house was not only being used to take in ex-prostitutes, repentant and unrepentant, but also to discipline nuns and to house a variety of welfare and correctional cases. The increase in involuntary membership in Santa Valeria, which was reflected in the house's growth, had a considerable impact on the character of the conventite. For the girls and women who came in unwillingly, the experience of duress was pressing because their residence in the conventite was generally expected to be permanent, although the definitiveness of this varied somewhat between the houses. In the Siamese house, which was more informal, all the sisters had taken the habit, but with one exception, they had made no vows, and they thought at least they had the possibility of leaving and going home to their families. in Milan, as in many of the houses, the sisters did take some form of vow. In this instance, a vow of stability, which meant that they could not leave the institution. In some instances, the women later decided that life in the Condatita was acceptable. And this also happened in convents, where women entered unwillingly and then later decided that it was acceptable, and to some degree at least, for them to be there. 15 of the Milanese sisters who had originally entered unwillingly now said that they were remaining voluntarily, but a much larger group of 33 stated their continuing unwillingness to stay. The effect of the religious framework of the Convertite was to bind these women to an unchosen and demanding form of existence, a permanent confinement. The resulting psychological tensions were expressed dramatically by Sister Maddalena, the one nun in the Siamese Convertite who had taken a vow. In quotes, "I have never been here willingly, because they brought me with sighs and I came weeping. I do not have the heart to observe the rules, and as I stand here, I believe it will be my damnation. I do not want to do evil, because I have made a vow not to sell in my body." The reaction to confinement expressed itself more directly in open resentment, defiant behavior, and attempts of escape and suicide. The visitor in Milan noted that one of the sisters was, in quotes, "accustomed to curse those responsible for her being there." For the institution as a whole, the presence of a fairly substantial group of unwilling members was very damaging to the ideal of religious community, which was envisioned at least as an aspiration for the house. The young nuns were disorderly and dissolute. According to older sisters' reports, many of them publicly expressed their wish for a husband. When they were at work, instead of chanting litanies or the name of the Lord, they would sing profane love songs. Moreover, the traditional convent system of imposing penances to maintain discipline in the house was not proving effective with them. Added to this was the turmoil created by the handful of delinquent nuns doing penance at Santa Valeria. They expressed their resentment at their surroundings by encouraging the discontented convertite to try and flee. They also aroused ill feeling in the house because of their special privileges and their snobbishness towards the socially inferior sisters. These internal tensions were greatly aggravated also by the poverty and inadequate administration of the house. The result, as one sister commented, was that community spirit had completely broken down. She said that there was no charity except between those who had special affection for each other, who were many. Unlike ordinary convents where family groupings tended to weaken community cohesion, among the Milanese Convertite, the reaction to confinement and hardship was the development of a buddy system similar to those found in modern women's prisons. According to one report, there were about 30 recognized couples in the house. One of their main functions was to see that when their friend got sick, she was provided with enough food and some nursing care. In a number of cases, these friendships became sexual relationships, although the officials tried to discourage this. Some of the younger nuns wore perfume and altered their habits, tightening the bodice and adding decorations to make themselves more attractive to their lovers. Thus, in the Convertite, the monastic ethos was being displaced by a set of personal relationships which were individualistic and emotionally oriented. In sum, assuming that the trends evident in the interviews are representative of the Italian Convertite as a whole, it is clear that they were evolving away from the intentions of their early founders, no longer a voluntary institution to provide spiritual rehabilitation. It is likely that in their earlier years, with a smaller membership and more religious enthusiasm, the houses did approximate their founders' vision. By the late 1570s, however, the emphasis was shifting from conversion to confinement, with accompanying changes in the internal atmosphere of the house. One can observe something of the same phenomenon in Italian convicts at the time because of the increased enforced monasticization, but to a lesser degree. None of the interviews that I've seen with nuns in ordinary convents reveal a high level of sexual tension, defiant behavior, and disintegration that was present among the convertite. This was probably because of the compensating network of family relationships and the restraining influence of upper-class mores. For the convertite, without these mitigating factors, and with a fairly high proportion of unwilling members, the psychology and interpersonal relations of confinement tended to dominate the house. From an institutional point of view, the houses of convertite follow a general 16th century trend in both Roman Catholic and Protestant countries to move social problems off the city streets into a corrective environment. But whereas Protestant areas developed new secularized welfare institutions, Roman Catholic areas, as Brian Pullen has shown for Venice, often adapted existing medieval bodies in order to deal with current social problems. Even new institutions like the Soccorso and the Vitelle were formulated within a traditional religious context. In the case of the convertite, the Mary Magdalene image and the convent model had been combined to create a very temple spiritual environment. With the shift in its population that is evident in the 1570s interviews, the convertite's total spiritual environment was transformed into a super penal institution. But whether in the mode of conversion or confinement, it was institutionally distinct from a pragmatic and secular response to prostitution.
Our next speaker is Professor Jane Abrey, who received her PhD from Yale in 1978 with a dissertation on the evolution of the Reformation in Strasbourg from 1520 to 1598. She's currently an assistant professor at Scarborough College at the University of Toronto. She has several publications in the area of the Strasbourg Reformation and on French Calvinists in Strasbourg. She's also gone further afield with a very interesting article which many of us use in our women's studies courses on feminism in the French Revolution. Today she's going to speak on insanity in 16th century Strasbourg. Ladies and gentlemen, one fall day in 1553, Meinhard Lipstein took an axe and gave his mother 40 whacks, or at least enough whacks to kill her. His judges, the magistrates of the free city of Strasbourg, might have locked him up for this crime. They might have put him to death. What they chose to do was to lock him up. A little less than 2 years later, they paroled him to what remained of his family, asking them to keep watch on Meinrad and above all to keep sharp objects out of his hands. Lipstein had been driven to violence and saved from his usual deserts by one fact. He was insane. He was one of a procession of mad or feeble-minded people over whom the Strasbourg authorities sat in judgment throughout the 16th century. The presence of these people in their territories posed three questions for the city's magistrates. First of all, who really would count as insane in the eyes of the law? How would the courts establish who was insane? Second, how should those people be treated in the courts? And third, once you've got them through the court system, what do you do with them then? The Strasbourg courts defined insanity under the same two broad categories which concern modern Anglo-American jurisprudence, incompetence and irresponsibility. Incompetence was a matter for the civil law. Someone was incompetent, for instance, if conditions like feeble-mindedness or delusion make a person incapable of managing his own fortune, of looking after his property. Irresponsibility
on the other hand, was a matter for the criminal law. Meinrad Lipstein was not held to be responsible for the murder he did because he was insane. The incompetent and irresponsible together make up the category of the legally insane, which is a kind of subgroup between the, within the much larger picture of the mentally ill. Renaissance medical theory recognized a wide variety of mental illnesses. The big catch-all, of course, is melancholy. Doctors might also diagnose conditions like frenzy or furor, sopor or stupor, suicidal mania, delusions, nymphomania or satyriasis, hysteria, senility, demonic possession, and others besides, and then as well the somehow related categories of feeble-mindedness and epilepsy. However, the doctor's learning was of very little relevance to the magistrates, to the judges. The magistrate's concern was not with the medical diagnostic intricacies of whether a given person were deluded, senile, what have you. What the magistrates had to decide was whether or not psychological or physiological impairment made the person either incompetent or irresponsible. Their interest, therefore, was in the consequences, not the nature of mental illness. The magistrates, therefore, almost entirely neglected the diagnostic classifications, the vocabulary that the doctors used. The lawyers instead taught in the simplest and least precise terms. They talk about people who are crazy in the head, sick in the head, not right in the head, witless, robbed of their wits, foolish. And that is as far as they will go in providing any kind of diagnostic category for these people. As a result, it's almost impossible to take the information in the Strasbourg records and slot the cases into either Renaissance or modern diagnostic categories. Now, in modern Anglo-American jurisprudence, the conflict between the medical definition of insanity, medical definition of mental illness, excuse me, and the legal definition of insanity makes the identification of who's insane extremely difficult. We're all familiar with the newspaper stories about people coming to trial, the question of insanity arises, long debates, conflicting testimony from medical authorities. The core of this problem exists in Strasbourg, the potential for the problem. But the problem itself is not developed yet. The Strasbourg judges evaluated incompetence and irresponsibility without recourse to expert medical testimony. As in France and in England, doctors were not routinely called upon to give opinions on the mental health, if you like, of the person before the court. As a result, the conflict between the medical and the legal points of view, the conflict among physicians themselves, have not yet become the issue in jurisprudence that they will be in the 19th and 20th centuries. Nor did the Strasbourg judges have to deal with clerical opinion, with the opinions of their theologians. Occasionally, in some cases involving religious delusions, the clergy might be consulted. But when this happened, it was more a case of consulting clergymen who knew about the case firsthand, a concerned neighbor kind of testimony, rather than going to the clergy because the clergy were theological experts. In Strasbourg, then, the responsibility for evaluating sanity lies with the secular judges alone. It's not a province for the doctors or the clergy. The secular nature of insanity proceedings in Strasbourg, I think, deserves to be underlined. Certainly, the magistrates, like the doctors, agreed that mental illness might be caused either naturally or supernaturally. For instance, the magistrates thought that a woman named Mad Margaret, who crawled about on her hands and knees during church services, suffered from a lack of good and warm food. And that was what caused her problem. They also recognized epilepsy as a natural affliction. On the other hand, they told a man named Dwight Lionsell, who was both mad and violent, that his problem arose because he didn't go to church and didn't respect God's word. When they were looking at the case of an apprentice weaver who had hanged himself, they wanted to know whether or not he had acted out of insanity or at the devil's prompting. My point, though, is that cases like the weavers, cases like Niantos, are extremely rare. They are exceptional cases. The magistrates almost never introduced a supernatural dimension into their discussions of insanity. Like Felix Plater, one of the great medical professors of the later 16th century, they left a place for God and the devil, but it was a very small place. Before we abandon the supernatural, something should be said about the relationship between religious deviance and madness. In Strasbourg, heresy was not in itself a sign of mental illness. And as we shall see in a few minutes, mental illness couldn't be used as an extenuating factor in heresy trials. Finally, witchcraft is something that is often connected with insanity in this period. In Strasbourg, the city records preserve almost nothing on witchcraft prior to the very late 1590s, and as a result, witchcraft escapes the scope of my paper entirely. So, the magistrates then in Strasbourg proceed, in general, 90% of the time, as if insanity is a natural and a secular phenomenon. Acting without recourse to expert testimony from doctors and theologians, they had less trouble than do modern judges in establishing who was legally insane. In drawing the distinction between insanity and sanity, they relied on common sense and on their own judgment. When it was a matter of determining competence, they examined the person themselves, they heard testimony from relatives, from friends, from others who knew about the case firsthand. Strasbourg doesn't seem to have developed anything like the elaborate procedure in use in England at this time, where chancery writs empowered royal officials to impanel juries to hear evidence of idiocy. The Strasbourg proceedings seem to be much more informal. However, it's likely that the Strasbourgers tested competence in much the same way as the English did. It's a matter for the civil law, and not unnaturally, the tests center on ability to distinguish profit from loss, ability to recognize different kinds of coins, financial kinds of knowledge then. Probably, the standard of competence would be quite low for the poor and would rise with the fortune of the person concerned, for the obvious reason that the more property you have to manage, the more competent you need to be, or if you're going to lose it. In evaluating criminal responsibility, the Strasbourgers again would seek direct testimony about who is this person, what's this person like. Here, though, they would tend to a very restrictive definition of insanity. In criminal cases, unless the accused were clearly and blatantly deranged, they were held to be responsible for their actions. There are a few cases in which we have descriptions of what a criminally insane person in Strasbourg was like. These people are described as raving, as ripping their clothing or going naked, as being prone to regular fits of violence, and often deluded about their identities. In short, they are really seriously disturbed people. In dealing with those they held to be insane, whether by incompetence or irresponsibility, the Strasbourg magistrates had one overriding goal: to protect the people, mad or sane, simple or wise, under their jurisdiction. The insane had to be protected from themselves and from the normal rigor of the law. The sane had to be assured their rights to property, to peace, and to salvation. The city's criminal and civil law provided the mechanisms for achieving these goals. The major concern of the civil law, as it applied to insanity, was of course to guard people's property and property rights. Men and women who were found to be incompetent to administer property had to be prevented from destroying the family fortunes, both to ensure their own subsistence and also to protect the rights of their heirs. In common with other late medieval and Renaissance judges, the Strasbourg magistrates used the old Roman device of curatio to ensure this. It works very simply. You appoint a guardian, a curator, to look after the financial problems for the person who's been found incompetent. Thus, when a miller named Wilhelm Bloom fell ill, the magistrates appointed a man named Mikkel Schwenker to run Bloom's affairs and particularly to manage the mill. On the criminal side, in Strasbourg, the mad were not normally punished for their crimes, unless those crimes had quite clear religious implications. Murder could be excused, as it was for Manuel Lipstein. So could assault, as it was for an unnamed madman who nearly beat to death a magistrate, Andreas Graf. Both Lipstein and Graf's assailant were locked up to protect the general public, but they were not punished as murderers or perpetrators of assault. Suicide was a crime in Strasbourg. The suicide's body was supposed to be put in a barrel and thrown in the Rhine. But the body of an insane suicide could be given a Christian burial. In minor cases of blasphemy, even, minor cases, insanity might be considered sometimes as an extenuating factor. Georg Fubelrad was sentenced to be pilloried and whipped in 1540 for some unrecorded blasphemy. After the sentence had been passed, his friends and family intervened with the magistrate, testifying that he was sick in the head. The punishment was commuted. Fubelrad was extremely lucky. Consider another court case. 1569, a soldier named Georg Koch gets drunk, announces while in his cups that the Romans would not have crucified Christ if he hadn't done something to deserve it. Yeah, well, it's a short story. Somebody reported the remark, Koch was arrested. His comrades and officers came before the magistrates, testified both to his valiant service in defense of Christianity against the Turks, and also to his personal and family history of mental illness. The magistrates refused to bend. Crazy or not, Koch was beheaded, his corpse mutilated, and the body burned. He was put to death to protect the citizens of Strasbourg. The magistrates reasoned that if the city allowed so monstrous a blasphemer to go unpunished, that God would wreak a terrible vengeance on the whole city. Obviously, in a case like this, the insanity defense cannot survive the operation. Nor could it be used in cases of religious deviance. Heretics and false prophets led souls astray. Mad or not, they had to be stopped. Consider the case of Martin Steinbach and Illiterate Cooper. Steinbach claimed, first of all, to be the prophet Elias, and then escalated his claims and announced that he was the Holy Ghost. His followers freely admitted that they could make no sense whatsoever out of his prophecies. What if all of them escaped him? Steinbach, then, is deluded about his identity, and he raves. He is nevertheless punished exactly as if he were sane. He is exiled, thrown out of town. Throughout the 1540s and 1550s, a man named Georg Ziegler, also known as Georg Narr, Georg the Fool, was making life difficult for the local clergy by street preaching, by disrupting sermons, by recording and trying to publish his visions, by capering about in fool's clothing. The magistrates called him simple-minded. They blamed his behavior on something wrong in his head. Nevertheless, he too is treated exactly as if he were sane. He is variously admonished, arrested, and temporarily expelled. In criminal cases involving blasphemy and heresy, then, the need to defend over orthodoxy overrode concern for the special status of the insane. In this, Strasbourg practice again resembles that of France and England. Once a case involving insanity had cleared the courts, the Strasbourg authorities tried to avoid any further responsibility for the person involved. The simplest way to do this, of course, is just to exile a person, get him out of your territory. This, in general, was only done with foreigners, non-residents. Foreigners usually were sent away. Not because the magistrates thought that travel was peculiarly therapeutic, but because these penny pinching officials are as reluctant to take on the cost of paying for the foreign mad as they are to take on the foreign poor or wandering heretic or any other body that they can slough off on someone else. Foreign epileptics are usually given either a nice lodging or a bit of money sent across the Rhine. An Italian who shows up, thinks he's the Holy Roman Emperor, given 5 shillings and told, don't ever come back. Out. When dealing with their own subjects, however, the actual resident population of Strasbourg and its territories, the magistrate's preferred method of closing the books on a case is to transfer responsibility back to the family concerned. Across Europe, the mad and the mentally defective are considered to be the responsibility of their kin, primarily. Curators from the kinship circle will take care of the financial interests of the incompetent. The violent should be cared for by their families, if at all possible. If necessary, the city may rent out a guard to the family to help keep somebody under control. If the family is extremely poor, or if the patient is extremely violent, the city then might consider incarceration, locking them up. Unlike the Spanish, the Strasbourgers have no asylum to use for this. Instead, they farm the insane out over a variety of institutions. Strasbourg had a leprosarium, but no Michel Foucault. They didn't send the mad to the leprosarium. Just about every place else, though. The violent might go into prison cells or into the 8 special Narrenhäuslein in the great hospital. The nonviolent might be cared for out of city revenues in the poor travelers hospital or in the syphilis hospital. Whenever possible, the magistrates tried to send mad women into the old convents or béguinage. The city council records shed very little light on what sort of medical treatment the mad received. The great hospital had a resident physician. Presumably he and the city's private practitioners used the usual methods of purging, bleeding, special diets, prayer and conversation, shock therapy in the form of beatings. Occupational therapy, in the form of work, not make work, is used both in and out of the hospitals. For example, the magistrates decided that the best cure for Georg Heckel, a melancholy young pastor, was to send him to preach in a Strasbourg cathedral. It did not help. In the great hospital, those who were neither raving nor violent were put to work at all kinds of simple, strenuous labor, although I suspect this was done more to make them pay a part of the costs of their own incarceration than for any therapeutic end. In some cases, the clergy might get involved. Pastor Wolfgang Capito, for instance, took Mad Margaret, who was crawling around on the church floor, into his own household for a while to try to bring her back to her senses. That didn't work either. Okay. We've seen in Strasbourg that the secular courts have an established jurisdiction over the insane and procedures for dealing with them. Judges evaluated sanity without recourse to expert testimony, and as a result, their proceedings were simple. They acted to protect the rights of both the sane and the insane, to property and peace. In cases involving only secular matters, the insane were granted a protected status. In cases where religion was involved, the needs of the community at large outweighed the claims of the insane to special immunities. The treatment of the insane remained largely a private responsibility. The courts resorted to incarceration, rarely and reluctantly. In all this, Strasbourg was broadly typical of Renaissance practices. Typical enough, I think, to draw one conclusion and a couple of comments. The conclusion is simple and obvious. As George Rosen has argued, historians of law and medicine who describe the Renaissance as a period of benighted superstition, which compounded heresy, witchcraft, and madness, and then had no remedy for the resulting horror except the stake, seriously misrepresent the attitudes and practices of early modern authorities. In fact, madness was dealt with rationally, humanely, and without panic. Second, I think the reactions of the sane to the mad can illuminate a number of problems of interest to early modernists. Most obviously, a given society's definition of madness is a piece of its definition of normality. For instance, students of religious practice should find it useful to know at what point religious enthusiasm becomes stigmatized as madness, a boundary which the Strasbourg records leave regrettably vague. Finally, insanity is a form of deviance, peculiar in being involuntary, but obviously an abnormality. Some sociologists insist that deviants, including the mad, can teach us a great deal about the societies we study. In a recent article in the Journal of Social History, John C. Burnham tested this claim, the claim of those who argue that the mentally ill may, and I quote, grasp and represent the essence of culture and reality better than the sane. Burnham did this by examining the delusions of psychotics in a Tasmanian asylum between 1830 and 1940, only to conclude that they reveal nothing new about Tasmanian society. The same is true about the delusions of Renaissance Strasburgers. No student of the early modern period is going to be surprised to learn that these people organized religious and political fantasies around figures like the Holy Roman Emperor and the Holy Ghost. We know this. The mad, as mad, are of little use to historians. They are important, however, for what they can provoke the sane to tell us about themselves. Thank you.
Final paper, entitled The Geography of Crime in 16th Century Ethics, is a joint collaborative effort on the part of Professor Martha Ellis Francois of Indiana University and her research assistant, Laurie Wollner. Martha Ellis Francois has a PhD from Harvard in English history, where she worked with Robert K. Jordan. She has been a full professor at Northeastern University for many years. She's now dean and professor at Indiana University. She's done extensive work on witchcraft. She's currently working on a book, which I believe is a collaborative effort with Barbara Hannawald on social deviance in early modern Europe. Professor Francois' assistant in this project has been Laurie Wollner, who's here with us, who is a BA candidate in the honors program at Indiana University. She tells me that she's eventually headed for law school, where she will continue her interest in social deviance. And I might add, I learned last night that she is an accomplished and professional flutist as well. I hope that you will join in the discussion after this, Laura.
This is going to be a local study. I might just add, it's Indiana University at Indianapolis. The 16th century in England, especially its latter half, seems to have been a period when the stranger, or non-resident, would have been held in high suspicion. One needs only to recall the poor laws and problems that immigrants from the Low Countries suffered in places like Colchester and Halstead in Essex to substantiate that hypothesis. However, when the number of natives and non-natives are examined in the court cases, that hypothesis is not upheld. In fact, there seems to have been much more alarm about local people. In some kinds of cases, like witchcraft accusations and adulterous pregnancies, there were almost no non-natives recognized in the court cases. This paper examines the distribution of certain kinds of crime in the county of Essex from 1558 to 1603, especially when the accused was cited as a non-native as opposed to a native. The word crime is used in this sense of the same way as William L. Marshall and William Clark and other criminologists. Any act, in other words, injurious to the public against which the government prosecutes. That definition is entirely appropriate for Essex in the Elizabethan context, since in essence almost all cases presented in the secular and ecclesiastical courts were brought on behalf of the government, because Mayak was not only head of secular affairs, but also governor of the church. Even sexual offenses were called crimes in the court records by contemporaries. Only certain kinds of crime were both numerous enough to examine and were likely to have involved two parishes with any kind of regularity. Those were cases against people, including assault and homicide, cases against property, including theft, breaking, entering, and theft, breaking, entering, assault, and theft, and cases against society, including incontinence, adultery, pregnancy, and pregnancy adultery. After general discussion of those cases, a more detailed analysis of witchcraft accusations and their geographical aspects will follow,
And finally, a case study of stock is presented in which the value of searching parish registers for the accused is explored to determine how much crime was really a local matter and or was caused by outside influences. We speak today of the impersonality of life as conducive to increasing criminal behavior. Yet many homicides, rapes, and even burglaries are done by people known to their victims. In the more closely knit environment of Elizabethan England, that personal aspect was even more likely to have been true. The material for this study is taken from the extant secular and ecclesiastical records for Essex and the reign of Elizabeth. While Essex has fairly complete court records, even those have some missing session files, especially in the period 1558 to 1574, and for single years like 1594. However, it seems likely that our sample is representative, since there's no reason to suspect that more cases involving two places would have been lost than those involving one. With respect to the ecclesiastical court records, the act books from the archdeaconries of Essex and Colchester have been used. That means that approximately two-thirds, a little bit more than two-thirds of Essex is covered through that use. Besides the matter of incomplete records, the accuracy of court reporting about native parishes must be questioned. What constituted a native parish in the eyes of contemporaries must have had many answers based on different kinds of assumptions. While the mileage estimates made in this paper are rough because we do not know precisely where people lived in a parish, it seems fair to group the non-natives in such a way as to distinguish a real travel effort from a short walk. However, the categories of parishes side by side and parishes within 10 miles should not be seen as distinctly different. In fact, the only reason for making that distinction was that many parishes in Essex contain manors, parts of which are actually in two or three parishes, even sometimes more than three. We felt that might have clouded the issue among the tenants as to what the home parish actually was, since they would have attended manorial courts in many instances, not contingent on the parish itself. Yet the number of people cited as originating from contiguous parishes appears to indicate that parish boundaries did make some difference. In many categories of criminal behavior, the numbers coming from contiguous parishes are either comparable to or greater than those cited as coming from within 10 miles. With respect to how contemporaries determined what the home parish was, one might postulate that once someone grew up in a parish, he, she might always have been regarded as a native, but that cannot have been the case, at least in some instances. Parents were subject to question by the courts when they received their pregnant daughters back into their houses after they had been away. The poor law provides us with one more insight into contemporaries' views on nativeness, because they stipulated that a poor non-native discovered in one parish could be sent back to another parish in which he had last lived for 3 years to be cared for by that parish. Some people may indeed have wandered around from parish to parish, perhaps even picking up odd jobs to keep solvent. J.F. Coburn, in the Calendar of Assize Records, Essex Indictments, Elizabeth I, seems to have assumed the existence of that kind of a group, or at least that there was some confusion about where people lived. He considered all people with the same names who were presented in the same session to have been the same person, regardless of occupation or parish cited. That has not been done with the court session cases or the cases from ecclesiastical courts, because Coburn's assumption may be erroneous. Names in Elizabethan England were often very similar, even within the same family. Nor does Coburn's assumption take into account that people may have changed their names. It only assumes that they changed their parish or their occupation. In the first group to be examined, those harming people directly, other than witchcraft cases, it is interesting to note that of those assaulting others, only 28% were cited as from parishes different from their victims, while only 24% of those implicated in homicides were from different parishes. That seems to indicate that physical confrontations were much more likely to occur among people who already knew each other or at least had a possibility of knowing each other. Even those coming from a different parish usually were in a contiguous parish or within 10 miles. In a total case of thefts and combined assaults and thefts, the percentages for those involving two places were 38 and 39% respectively. For cases of breaking, entering of house, barn, or shop, assault, and theft, the percentage rose to 44%. Finally, for cases of breaking, entering a close, and theft, not including poaching cases, the percentage of cases involving two places constituted 64%. We've broken it down in order to see this kind of progression from one kind of case to another. Perhaps more non-natives were involved in breaking into closes because they thought that they could hide whatever they stole outside the parish more effectively than those living in the parish. But at least more non-natives were caught. While each of those percentages is fairly constant with respect to non-natives throughout all the periods, the actual number of cases from one five-year period to another did at times increase, especially in the period 1595 to 1599, except for homicides and breaking, entering, and theft of a close. That period, economically speaking, was a very difficult one in which the local inhabitants must have been very hard-pressed, indeed, in most Essex parishes, and correspondingly were accused more often of thefts as local inhabitants, not necessarily as strangers wandering around the countryside. Clearly, women participated in those kinds of crimes much less than men, especially in the non-native category. Only two women were engaged in assaults away from their native parish as compared to 83 women who were accused of assaults in their own parish. However, 187 men were accused of assaults away from their native parish, while 419 men were presented for assaults in their home parish. Proportionately speaking, women strayed from their parish much less than men with respect to homicides. Only 13 women were accused of having engaged in homicide. Of that number, all but one was a native. In the case of men, 106 were accused in their home parishes and 37 were engaged elsewhere. Not only was that true of homicides and assaults, but it was also true of thefts. On the one hand, 12% of those committing thefts away from the home parish were women. Only 12 women were engaged in combinations of assault and theft. Of those, two were accused of doing it elsewhere than their home parish. On the other hand, 190 men were involved, of whom 84 were committing the crime outside their own parish. With respect to the breaking, entering, and theft from a house, barn, or shop, again, the native males dominated, numbering 387, or 47% of all those involved. Of those who did those acts away from their home parish, 343, or 89%, were males, and only 11% were females. The largest proportion of those were traveling no more than 10 miles to commit their acts, 66%, in other words. Women were almost not apparent in breaking, entering, and theft from a close, constituting only 2% of those accused in a parish other than their own, and 9% of those accused in their own parishes. In cases of breaking, entering, and theft, only four women were accused, of whom only one was accused of doing the deed away from her home parish. In summary, then, women were seldom engaged in crime away from their parishes, and even men were not very prone to engage in crime as non-natives. Four kinds of sexual offenses seem appropriate to analyze in this context: incontinencies or fornications cases, incontinence adultery, pregnancies, and pregnancy adultery. In comparison to assaults, homicides, thefts, and breaking and entering combinations with thefts, those coming from outside the parish seem much smaller in number, suggesting that people were not as prone to go distances for sexual encounters as for the possibility of financial and or property gain. Or at least they weren't as readily caught. That they were not caught as readily seems unlikely because of the great number who were, in fact, caught. Bad people may have minded their neighbor's business more than that of a stranger does not seem possible, since every local community was worried about becoming responsible for bastards and or uncared for children, quite apart from the moral issues involved with the Frostburg. So, with respect to the four categories of sex offenses, Under analysis, most of the local inhabitants knew the names of the persons with whom they were wrongfully associated and their places of residence. I mention that because occasionally a woman will report, well, it was a man in a tawny coat with a little red hat. Although, as I say, occasionally, they couldn't do that. And occasionally, there was some doubt as to who the father might have been in pregnancy cases. However, that was because the woman in question had had intercourse with several men in the recent past or was threatened into accusing another man rather than the real culprit. Although the total percentage of the sex crimes involving two places is smaller than the percentages in categories involving crimes against people and property, still, there are some important observations to be made. Cases of pregnancy adultery were very few and seldom involved two places. Facts which suggest that perhaps marriage relationships may have been regarded as fairly secret. In many instances of pregnancy adultery, there had been an unlawful or an imposed separation as when the husband was fighting on the continent. With the exception of the contiguous parish category, there were more pregnancy cases among the cases involving two places, 49% of those within 10 miles, 48% of those over 10 miles, and 51% of those involving people from outside the county, including London. It is possible that a more accurate account of two places was kept when a bastard was at stake than when the problem was only one of fornication. Since witchcraft cases represent such a significant number of presentments in secular as well as ecclesiastical courts for this county, they warrant our special attention in this context of the geographical aspects of crime. Trevor Roper was the historian who decided that witches were most prevalent in mountainous areas like the Alps and the Pyrenees, in other words, in isolated, foggy, rural areas. The only problem with his explanation was that it did not work out with a number of areas, including Essex, which he included in those isolated places, foggy, isolated places. Essex appears to have had more witchcraft accusations than any other part of England, but it can hardly be considered as isolated. It is fairly flat and thus easily accessible for all those traveling, especially from London, from the south, to Suffolk, Norfolk, and Cambridge. Besides that, it was fairly densely populated and was not overly given to fog, to heavy fog. In fact, as McFarlane has shown, no part of Essex was without accusations. 161 parishes had witchcraft accusations in the period examined. Add to that parishes with sorcerers only, and you come out with a number of 175 parishes. Together, those parishes were roughly 43% of the parishes in Essex. All but two market towns were included. All cases involving two parishes where a so-called witch from one parish bewitched someone or animal or inanimate object in another parish occurred within 10-mile radius of the home parish. With one exception, and that's one married woman from outside the county, and that's actually a little outside our periods in the early Stuart period. All were married with one exception. Nine men were accused. At least one of those was married and did his bewitching with his wife. The greatest number of cases were done against people, 28, two times as many as those against animals and inanimate objects. That fear could have spread from one parish to another is something that we certainly have to take into account. For example, in 1570, in Thane Mount, one woman was accused of diagnosing the problems of another woman's husband and stemming from his bewitchment by someone in Naystock, a parish very close to Thane Mount. Sometimes the witches were accused of specific cases only in parishes other than their own, as in the case of a couple who came from Aberton. They were the only ones in their parish to be accused of general witchcraft during the same period, and they were also presented for misdemeanors such as not going to church, slander, and quarreling. Parishes which were side by side, such as Great and Little Clacton, may have been more prone to share witches. Certainly, the Sellis family was notorious in both parishes. The mother of the family was accused of numerous bewitchings, not least among them the plaguing of a man's cattle in her own parish. She, along with her husband and son, was accused of burning the same man's barn. But that time the charge was arson and not witchcraft. Clearly she was notorious, and therefore it's not surprising that she was known in two parishes side by side. While contemporary evidence about specific locations of most people is not available for many parishes, there are some parishes for which there is a limited amount of information for the general location of housing. Before examining the evidence, it might be postulated that the arrangement of housing in a parish might affect whether or not there are witchcraft cases, because it might affect people's relationships with each other or even reflect those relationships. Perhaps a tightly knit community might have avoided witchcraft cases stemming from societal problems, unless it was in the process of changing and thus fluctuating. Also, a community with a widely scattered housing might not have had witchcraft cases unless there were strangely behaving people wandering around the community. However, the evidence is not so complete that it allows for very precise deductions, but in most cases, it is impossible to know where the accused witch lived in relationship to the victim. While the housing in general could be widely scattered, there could have been a feud over boundaries of land between two families, or a variety of very practical issues among neighbors, which could have caused friction sufficient enough for witchcraft accusations in a period that was prone to them anyway. Moreover, people in widely scattered housing could have caused a situation more susceptible to suspicion about recent arrivals in the parish or people not usually seen there. Other parishes with some legitimate geographical evidence, 68 have no witchcraft accusations, roughly 17% of all the parishes and 28% of those without witchcraft accusations. 73 have some witches, roughly, again, 18% of all the parishes in Essex, and 45% of the parishes involved in witchcraft accusations. In comparison, the two groups seem to differ most in terms of parishes with two or more village clusters, with those with witchcraft accusations numbering twice as many as those with none. Also, of the 16 parishes with two or more village clusters, at least 9 had religious fragmentation, meaning the presence of friction between or among religiously opposed groups at the same time as the witchcraft accusations. Geographic distribution of houses may therefore have contributed both to the religious fragmentation and to the presence of witchcraft accusations. The presence of one village center occurred more often among those parishes without involvement in witches. Of the 29 parishes, one village and involvement in witches, at least 7 had religious fragmentation, so that the seeming unity of the presence of one parish center is deceptive. Although the parish center situated some distance from the parish church was not a deciding factor for the presence of witchcraft accusations, it must have contributed to slack attendance at parish church and probably to religious friction, since at least 3 parishes of the 5 cited for so-called witches gave evidence of that kind of friction. Parishes with scattered housing seem to have had a slight dominance among parishes without witchcraft involvement, but again, with respect to the 17 cited with witchcraft involvements, at least 9 had religious fragmentation. Furthermore, it should be observed that scattered housing meant, at least in the parishes of some size, that most of the inhabitants were probably some distance from the parish church, so that its place in holding people together, some kind of unity, especially religiously, may have been weakened. Finally, it should be noted that the only examples of parishes combining a largely rural population with a decided market center, not coinciding with the parish church, all had witchcraft involvement. They also had religious fragmentation coinciding with that witchcraft accusations. Their special geographical features must have contributed to their fragmentation in some measure in a period, again, ripe for bewitchment. Thus, while geographical features alone do not explain the occurrence of witchcraft accusations in the early modern period of English history, they may well have contributed to the societal background in which they occurred. Sometimes the fact that there was a center may have created greater tensions or may have lessened them according to what else was happening in that center and in the parish as a whole. The few cases involving two parishes stresses the personal quality of the accusations, that the people involved usually knew each other, perhaps not well, but still had a sense of belonging to the same community, religious in nature, but also administrative. Church wardens and constables, as well as the parish church and its minister, helped to reinforce that. Although the parish may have been fragmented religiously and even economically, it was still important to people as their basic unit of societal organization. The parish of Harvardstock, or Stock as we refer to it, was not a chance selection on our part to do our first study of a parish register. There was some inevitability involved in it. We were searching for copies of printed parish registers in this country, and the first one we were able to obtain was Stock. The parish of Stock is located in the central portion of Essex, and one time was a hamlet of Buttsbury. However, gradual population shift occurred over the 1300s and 1400s into the 1500s, and Stock became the more important parish of the two. Because of that migration, the boundary between Stock and Buttsbury was not definite, and both of these parishes shared a common village. Certainly, our analysis of the local criminal patterns only supports the assertion that there was more alarm about local inhabitants than non-natives, as we call them. While the term non-native is easier to define as anyone designated from another parish, the term native or local inhabitant is much harder to define. How long did a person have to be in a parish to be regarded from that parish? Were all those designated as of a parish to be found in the parish registers as baptized, married, and or buried? Every parish register has certain limitations which must be taken into account. Were they kept accurately? Did everyone in the parish perform the duties of baptism, marriage, and burial in the appropriate parish church? In fact, the Stock parish register has even more apparent limitations. From 1563 to 1580, all christenings, marriages, and burials were noted. Unfortunately, however, the register after 1580 only contains christenings. That has hindered the study because marriages and burials are important factors in determining whether or not people were actual natives or temporary residents. Despite that limitation, it seems possible to construct four categories: no natives, potential native population, transient population, and non-natives. The criteria for the first category, the known natives, are based on the following assumptions. Those people who have been found with complete names in the parish register are considered known natives. However, most of those have not necessarily been found as christened or married or buried in the parish, but rather have sons or daughters who are christened. For example, one of the incontinence citations, 1584, was of a man named Thomas Bush. According to the register, on October 27, 1593, Agnes, the daughter of Thomas, was christened. The assumption has been made that he married and continued to reside in the parish with his family. That kind of reference has been found for several people, with the result that they have been categorized as non-native. Others have been included in that category because they were either christened or married in the parish prior to the 1580s. The second category is that of potential native. The criteria for this category stipulates that although the person was cited as from Stock, only the surname of the individual was found in the parish register, and or there were several offenses charged against the same individual over two or more years. The fact that some of their surnames appear in the parish register implies that they may have had relatives, at least in the parish, if they hadn't themselves been long-term residents. A good example of those with several offenses over two or more years was Christopher and Barbara Driver. There's no mention of this surname in the register anywhere, but they were cited in 1572 for not attending church and for whoredom. And in 1584, Barbara was again cited for, not whoredom specifically, but incontinency, adultery. They may have been servants or boarders of some kind in the parish, yet they were probably considered as natives by the community because of the length of time they spent in the parish. The third category, the transient population, includes those presented from Stock, whose surnames were not found in the register. That criteria seems legitimate because many people were temporary or seeking service. An example of that kind of person would be Richard Brock's servant, Henry King. He was cited as a tempter and beggar of honest maidens to commit fornication and filthiness. Plus the fact he was specifically cited for incontinency with a woman who might very well have been a servant of another couple. The fourth category contains non-natives, as presented in the court records. They only represented 9% of the total defendants cited in the parish during the years 1558 to 1563. Again, the smallness of their number
suggests that the inhabitants were much more suspicious of their immediate neighbors, but Stock probably did not see many non-natives in proportion to micro towns like Colchester and Brentwood. There was a total of 9 cases presented for crimes against people involving only 6% of the defendants. More of the defendants were known natives and potential natives, with a transient population constituting only 22%. The total number of male and female defendants presented for offenses against property constituted 35 people, or 24% of the total citations. 43% of those defendants committed their crime in another parish, while 29% committed their crimes in Stock. The transient population constituted 46% of the defendants who committed property offenses, of which 93% committed their crimes outside of Stock. The native population represented 11% of the defendants who committed property offenses, of which 25% of those defendants committed their crimes in another parish. The potential native group represented 17% of the defendants who committed property offenses, and 17% of those individuals committed their crimes outside of Stock. The non-native population represented 26% of those property offenders. Offenses against society, including all sexual offenses, constituted the largest single category of crime in Stock. The non-natives constituted 35%, the potential natives were 13%, the transient natives totaled 46%, the non-natives constituted only 6%. The final category, crimes against religion, 57% were natives, 14% were potential natives, and 29% were part of the transient population. The study of the parish register of Stock indicates, with respect to the total number of defendants, 53 or 35% were known natives, 23 or 16% were potential natives, 60 or 41% were transient population, and 13 or 9% were non-natives. It appears that the transient population was accused more often than any other group. They may have been more likely to have been accused or more prone to actual acts, or else their apprehension was more frequent. Since those individuals were probably more likely to have been suspected by the native community, the actual commission of crimes could be exaggerated, but clearly it appears that the transient population is a significant group to take into account. While this examination of the Stock Parish Register is hardly sufficient, the single exercise and analysis does indicate that a thorough search of several parish registers would throw more light on who was committing crimes of all kinds and where they were committing them. The transient population may well have been the most suspected and thus the most accused, especially in sexual crimes. However, the role of the non-native in offenses against property needs more exploration, especially with respect to different kinds of parishes, like largely agrarian or market center, to see if the non-native population participated more or less with characteristics germane to specific kinds of communities. Despite all the questions left unanswered, we have confirmed our view that geographical aspects of crime are important to take into account with respect to understanding 16th century criminal behavior. The number of those committing sexual offenses reveals much more concern for the morality of the local inhabitants than those of non-natives, while forms of theft cases showed more non-natives being cited, but not more in different periods proportionate to the total accusations. A geographical approach to which theft accusations shows an emphasis on local inhabitants and suggests even more emphatically that those accusations should be reviewed in the light of local problems.
Interested at the point at which available knowledge, there's no way to guess whether or not the person has any kind of symbolic problem.
So I didn't even know that I could look at that. That might be more associated because people who are leprosy are drawn up to stages in the sanitary.
Right.
Whereas with syphilis, when we have a new case, there are very severe things. Or to stash a good there to sell them, you know, to get the high.